Are there any questions? Maybe this is just a good time to just, you know, maybe you had a question as we talked about Anthony, or maybe other things related to the show itself that you thought, well, I'd like to hear a little more about this or that. Anything, we could be happy to do that.
In the realm of Desert Fathers, it's not yeah. something I've looked into, but you guys referenced it, and here's one of them. Is there, what is that, what would we find if we looked into the Desert Fathers?
Well, Glenn would know more than me, because yes. yeah, I'm just an Anthony guy.
Yeah, the Desert Fathers are a group of Christian leaders who lived basically in the Egyptian desert. And they left actually a significant body of writings behind them. They were very important in the early development of the monastic tradition. And as I said, there's surprisingly direct connections between the Desert Fathers in Egypt and Ireland. Hmm. So the Irish Church was heavily influenced by them. But they in turn are going to influence people like John Cassian and others who are going to be critical in the formation of monasticism, both in the Eastern Church and in the West.
Peter has it as part of our required reading at the office.
So okay, so in the Desert Fathers generally? Yeah, great. Yeah. So there is a work that is entitled The Desert Fathers, if I recall. It's just selections from different
from
writings.
Benedicta Ward.
What's that?
Benedicta Ward as the author.
Okay. Well, then, there you go.
So you mentioned part of what led you to this topic was the encroachment of totalitarianism
right.
in our modern day.
Right.
And from the pursuit of asceticism that Anthony really spent much of his life with, what are some of the things that we could or should give up and distance ourselves from in order to increase our own Christian liberty in an environment like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've got a real mixed sense of things. On the one hand, I think it's important for us. So I am a Protestant. I am in the part of the Reformed tradition, and I believe in dominion and doing what we can to be an influence in our culture and fulfilling our vocations where we find ourselves. But I do think we need a greater emphasis on self-denial, not mainly because we're trying to, like I said earlier, save ourselves, but mainly because we're trying to be free from the influences of a fallen world and the lies. We don't want to be easy marks. We want to be able to. So like when I think about contemporary ascetics, I think about someone like Solzhenitsyn, you know, who's in, you know, the gulag. You know, it's that kind of thing. We need to be able to be people who can discern the lies and not afraid to say that's a lie. So that's the thing about those guys that intrigues me. Yeah, Brian?
Yeah, it actually kind of made me think, too, even what you were saying about Adam and Eve, if Adam would have asked, but maybe he couldn't have asked because he wasn't walking. Like,
yeah.
he, taking the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
But he had to obey first. If he had obeyed,
yeah.
he could have got wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that we sometimes fall into the trap of thinking we have to be, you know, experienced with sin to be wise. When I think, in fact, you know, the law of the Lord is given to us to make us wise in spite of ourselves. If you just do what the law says, you'll be wise, right? That, by the way, is, I think, kind of the undercurrent of Paralandra, you know, Lewis's second book. So in Lewis's second book in the Space Trilogy, you have a tempter who comes to the Venetian Eve and fails to get her to sin. And she grows wise through obedience. So as she resists temptation, she grows wise. So at the end of the story, she's like very wise because she's resisted.
Well, to answer Anthony's question, I mean, I think we all have the obvious, you know, pornography, gambling, drugs. You know, I mean, those are all the obvious things. But I think I think just leisure. I think leisure time. I mean, we're not ascetics necessarily, but I think we tend to define a good job and a good life as one that affords you a lot of leisure time, and you don't grow wise typically in leisure time unless you're using that leisure time to work in some other way, you know. So it's not, so recreation doesn't mean scrolling Twitter, yeah, sure, or scrolling, right. You know, recreation could mean opening a book and studying or learning a new skill, or putting in some extra time at work to try to move the business forward, you know, or whatever. So I think that's one thing that you could deny yourself is just kind of entertaining.
Well, actually, the origin of leisure time,
yeah,
is not time that we have to do whatever we want, but it's time that we give to higher things.
Yeah, that's good.
That's what leisure originally meant, giving yourself to developing things like art, or reading another language,
yeah,
or, you know, being able to, so you can translate something from one of these bodies.
It's more like extracurricular.
Yes, it's like, okay, I'm finished with the main work, now I'm going to get to the stuff that I needed to do for an entire lifetime so that I can be ready for eternity. So that was Joseph Pieper, Roman Catholic writer, wrote Leisure, a book called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, which he said it's worship and art and beauty that gives the basis of a culture. And so people take the time that they're not doing, because like the people who built cathedrals, many of them built those on their own time. They would have their regular jobs, and then they would, in some cases, people would haul stones when they were, you know, that they would have to finish what they were doing for that period of the season and then go. So, you know, all of that comes together as things that we're called to do beyond just our regular day-to-day work.
Yeah, it's good.
Also, I think of your sermon. So yesterday, he was talking about 1 Corinthians 6:12. It's like, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. And just that reminder of, you know, I can do all the things in Christ kind of thing, but in some ways, yes, because His Spirit in us, we can fight these things. You know, it's not, you know, we're not in our flesh trying to fight these things, but in Christ, we are more than conquerors in that. It's that reminder that because He's defeated, that's such a good reminder when they can look at these demons and be like, they have no power here, literally, because Christ has crushed them in His death and in His resurrection. And so that, in that, we have hope. And looking at this, it's like, okay, I will not be dominated, even though our culture is like, hey, just give in. Hey, what's another life? What's another scroll? What's another click? What's another X, Y, Z? But we're being reminded that, you know, we have somebody in us who has conquered all of this, lived as a human, and wrestled the flesh, and was tempted in every way, but did not give in. And that is our hope.
Yeah, yeah. There's a classic distinction made by all sorts of thinkers between freedom from and freedom for. So we were wrapped up with freedom from, you know, and that's good. You know, we want to be free from some things. But freedom for, so for example, I'm free to run a marathon, but I'm not free to win. You know, in other words, to be free to win, I have to train. You know, I have to work. I have to do all the things that the self-discipline is called for to win a race. And so that's freedom for. And I think that's where Anthony is. You know, he's both. He's freedom from, but he's also freedom for.
I'm curious, though, like, where would the battle... I was thinking of a friend of mine who's a Presbyterian pastor in Colorado, but he talks about a friend when he was a missionary in India, this Roman Catholic priest who was a performed exorcisms.
Yeah.
Did hundreds of them in India. Then they came back to the States and said he didn't want. Like there was not a need to do them. And it's not because the dynamics of being in India and the spiritual oppression there and here is almost this welcome, like it,
right,
sort of just welcome it.
Yeah.
And it's not the same type of battle. But where would an Anthony today? Like, where, like, he went off in the desert, but there's not.
Yeah.
where would you go?
Yeah, I know the point. That's a good point. I can tell you want to say something there.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot more going on in terms of demonic activity in the United States than we recognize. And we call it other things. You know, we call it mental illness. We call it obsessive compulsive behavior. We call it, you've got any number of terms for it. Addictions, on and on and on. I'm not saying that all of these things are actually caused by demonic activity, but as I read the New Testament, it looks to me like at least some of them might be. The difference is that in India, demons, because of the, well, worldview of the culture, can be much more overt in what they're doing. Here, they like to do things covertly. Well, and then on top of that, we have a culture that denies their existence and so comes up with all kinds of other terms and definitions for what we're seeing.
Yeah, and those terms and definitions haven't been very helpful in actually addressing the problems that people are supposedly diagnosing. I've noticed that. But I think, too, that, say, people from places like India are more attuned to these things and are maybe more discerning. I remember I've had a number of people in my churches over the years from India and other places where it's kind of the awareness of the spiritual, the unseen realm is very acute. And I remember one couple, when they bought a new home, said, "Pastor, we want you to come over and pray over every room of the house." And the purpose was to exorcise spirits. They were Presbyterians from India. And this is what pastors do in India. When you buy a home, yeah. When you buy a home, the first thing you do before you move in is the pastor goes in and makes certain that there are no demonic forces somehow present in the home. So I did it. I went through the house and prayed in every room. Yeah.
Kind of going back to one of the earlier points, one of the prayers I discovered in Psalm 119 is "Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things." Mm. And given how visual our culture is and how we're saturated with, I mean, here I am, but that notion of, you know, Lord, I need you to help me discipline my habits so that I'm not wasting all this time.
Yeah.
And I just find that a very effective prayer in my own life. Just turn my eyes from looking at those things. And it's amazing how many things I've been able to stop watching and stop doing just with that one prayer.
Yeah, that's great. So just thinking kind of about spiritual disciplines, fasting, I don't have the insight to explain why fasting is important or anything, but I have noticed that when I fast over an extended period of time, a hunger pang is a kind of like an alarm bell to pray. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of like a reminder, okay, time to pray every time I feel like an interest in food. Okay, time to pray. Why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing this because such and such situation is really important, and I need to prioritize it over other things, even, you know, obvious needs like physical substance, but it's not like I'm going to die tomorrow if I don't eat today, you know, you know, that kind of thing.
But there is a kind of a recognition of that's what you're doing, is you eat to live. I mean, oddly, you kill things to eat them, to live.
Hey, you go to the grocery store and it's full of dead things. Everywhere you look, there's dead stuff.
But then by not eating, you're basically moving in the direction of death.
Yeah, right. That's a great thought. I hadn't thought of that.
The fasting also reminds you how much the body is in control.
Yeah.
And how much we just allow the body to dictate to us. And so the act of fasting helps. It makes you face that so that you understand. You know, I've got to operate on a higher plane.
Yeah. It was in Hebrews, Paul talks about you have not resisted sin to the point of death. Okay, you've got some, you've got like a sort of a learning curve here. All right, well, this is great. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you.